Zoom from wherever they happen to be as well. And I thought maybe we'd choose a topic that relates very closely to what we're studying in YU this year, which is Maseches Gittin. So Gittin is a big Masechta, about 90 blot, and although the name suggests that it deals with the divorce process, and that's certainly true, there are many related and unrelated topics that that are sprinkled throughout the Masechta. And we're going to talk about one which I think even touches upon Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving is a fascinating case study in the world of how cultures have diffused and integrated into American society, and vice versa. And it's particularly interesting when we think about how generally Jewish culture, even in America, is somewhat insular, depending on the community, to different degrees. But even in a modern Orthodox community such as ours, where we do draw certain lines, you know, socially, educationally, family-wise, and so forth, to preserve its unique flavor. And of course, I don't just mean the chicken soup and the gefilte fish, but the community is the community because of how we preserve our unique identity. Nevertheless, when it comes to Thanksgiving, at least as a legal holiday, right, also as a moment to gather and reflect on the theme of the day and the turkey, right? So it's long been adopted into what we would call the standard fare of a major portion of the Orthodox population. How that evolved and how that is impacted by halacha is not our discussion today, although it is very convenient that it works out for the first time until 2040-something that Thanksgiving is Rosh Chodesh and vice versa, because that actually helps with the springboard of the topic. Right? We can call it Thanksgiving. We could also call it Hallel and Hodu Lashem Kito Kilei Olam Chasdo. Of course, the Hebrew name for turkey is Hodu. Okay, so it works out beautifully, because the theme is that when we think about the cultural diffusion, the overlap of Thanksgiving into our Jewish culture, there's another thing which the name of Thanksgiving, names in general, Hebrew names, Jewish names, secular names, there's so many different combinations. And they've also sort of found their way, for as long as there have been Jews, you know, in this country. Although, you know, when I was growing up, the first Jew in revolutionary times, one of the most famous Jews, one of the supporters of George Washington was Chaim Solomon, right? So he still went by his Jewish name from, I don't know where his parents were. They were still from Europe. But Chaim Solomon. And over the generations, it became very commonplace for Jews in our country and in every country to take on names that were not patently Jewish and were not Hebrew or not Yiddish at all. And the truth is, we'll talk about this in a little while, Yiddish names like Razel, it's not actually a Hebrew word, it's not actually a Jewish name, but somehow they became integrated into the commonplace practice of naming our children. I want to talk about the background, how it came to be. Is it okay? Is it not okay? Just to be a little provocative, different perspectives on the Shaila, and some other interesting historical points that are related, and some interesting points about naming children in general. So why is it so important to analyze this question? Why is it so important? So we're in Gullis, we're in Chutz La'aretz, we're outside of Eretz Yisrael, and we can recall a medrash in Vayikra Rabbah. The truth is, it's a little bit of a myth, because if you would ask someone, and this is what's taught to children in school, what were the three primary merits that the Jews had that allowed them to be taken out of Mitzrayim? So, Shloshinu es Malbusham, es Lashonam, ve es Shema. They did not change their manner of dress. They did not change their language. They spoke in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew, the language of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And they also did not change their names. Now, there's actually no medrash that says that. Okay? There are different medrashim that point to different highlights, but those three items don't appear in one medrash. There's a medrash that has four items, but doesn't have those three. But it doesn't mean that we should de-emphasize the importance of what the conglomeration of all those different factors still represents. So we have on the books, just to read you the medrash that has four items in it, Rav Huna Amar B'Shem Bar Kapara, B'Shvil Dal Dvarim Nigalu Yisrael Mitzrayim, Shloshinu Eshemam Veslashonam. Those two we have in this medrash, they didn't change their names or their language, and they didn't say Lashon Hara, and they were very careful about morality, okay? So we have the emphasis on the names. Now, I have to admit, I never paid attention to this, and I didn't hear anyone else observe this, but I just realized right now, isn't that fascinating? Rav Huna, Amar B'Shem Bar Kapara. The two individuals speaking, or Rav Huna in the name of Bar Kapara, neither of them have Jewish names. Isn't that mind-blowing, right? Rav Huna and in the name of Bar Kapara. Those are Aramaic names. We'll get back to that in a little while. But as we say in Hebrew, halo davarhu. What a fascinating point is that the ones who are teaching us this lesson are not actually consistent, or at least their parents were not consistent when they named them with the importance of the Jewish names. So this is so important, especially as we read these parshios, the identification of Jews by their names, right? Avram and Sarah got new names by the Ribbono Shel Olam, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when they took on this new role as being the father and the mother of Judaism. And Yitzchak is named by Hashem. Now, if I had to ask you who named Yaakov, what would you say? Oh, okay. So if you look at Rashi in this week's Parsha, Rashi brings two opinions. The Pasuk says, Vayikra Shmo Yaakov. But doesn't say who. Someone called him Yaakov. Who was it? One opinion is that it was Yaakov, and it had something to do with the heel. He was holding onto the heel of Esav. But the other opinion in Rashi, just it's on the page in your Chumash, you can see it there, says it was Hashem. I guess a voice came out of Shemayim, or someone had a nevuah that this child should be named Yaakov. So it's not a coincidence that as the Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, to take on this role as the leaders of the Jewish nation, they had to be given new names. Now, it's not entirely compelling, because Rivka and Rachel and Leah did not receive new names. They went by the names of Lavan and Basua, whatever they gave them as babies. How ironic is it that the wife of Esav gets a new name? Esav had three or four wives, okay? But one of them, believe it or not, was named Yehudis. Okay, how ironic is that the only one of the wives of those generations was actually Esav's wife, and her name was Yehudis. Rashi tells us it was a little bit disingenuous. Esav did a lot of things to trick his parents, especially Yitzchak, and convince them that he was a big tzaddik like Yaakov. So he took a wife who had a name which was Alivama, not necessarily a Jewish name, and he named her Yehudis as if to represent or to misrepresent to his parents that this is a nice, frum girl, found her, on college campus, and she's really sweet, and her name is Judy, and not Yehudis. Okay, so that was Esav. Here was Esav parading around as a Yaakov, when we're used to Yaakov parading around as Esav, as we read in this week's Parsha. Just one final point of introduction. It's also relevant to notice that a newcomer to Judaism receives a new name. In fact, the very first thing that takes place when you get out of the mikveh, whether it's a man or a woman, is the name is given. Now, how do we give a name? How do we ever give a name? There's only one process we have for giving names. We make a mishaberach. After the bris milah, there's a mishaberach. If you get called to the Torah after the birth of a daughter, also mishaberach, v'ikarei shmo b'Yisrael. So other than maybe one or two people in the room who have heard that, you probably never heard the mishaberach that's given to a ger or a gioris fresh out of the mikvah. I'm going to read it to you from the RCA Life Cycle Madrich. Okay, this is a rabbi's cheat sheet. Okay, but very few of them have to look at page 60, conversion. Okay, there's one for males, one for females, but they're pretty similar. Elokeinu v'elokei avoseinu, Hatzlachna lager hazeh, bring success to this convert. Hanikra shemo b'Yisrael, whatever, fill in the blanks. Yaakov, ben Avram Avinu, or bas Avram Avinu. Meshoch alav chasdecha, spread your loving kindness upon the ger. And just give you the English translation, just as this individual was Zocha to join the Jewish people and to come under the wings of the Shekhinah, so too may you implant in this individual's heart the love and the awe and open up his heart or her heart to the Torah. Guide him or her upon the path of mitzvos to do the will of Hashem and find favor in your eyes. Amen kein yiratzon. It's a beautiful tefillah. I wish someone would say this for me. Who wrote this? That's a good question. I have to do a little more research. I'm not familiar who wrote the regular Mishaberach that we say all the time. I don't know. But it's been around for quite a while. Excellent question. Okay, so let's get into our topic, because as important as we demonstrated that the names in for the identity of Jews, we've seen a diffusion. There were some parts of history where it was mandated as a form of oppression and anti-Semitism that we had to take secular names of our cultures. And ironically, there were places where we were prohibited from taking Jewish names. Instead of a yellow star, you had to, go by the Jewish name so everyone would know who to persecute and who to give a hard time to. The very first Jew to really find his way integrated into non-Jewish society was Yosef. And what's the first thing we know about Yosef? He He was given a new name by Paro. It was not the only time Paro pulled that trick. He renamed Yocheved and Miriam, gave them the name Shifra and Pua. If we have time, we'll get back to that a little bit later, but B'nai Yisachar and other Sfarim suggest that was part of a plot. You know, Paro knew what was going on, and he felt that the only way he could control and dominate the Jewish presence in Mitzrayim was to rename them and give them a not-Jewish name, and somehow that would impact on their behavior and so forth. Okay, so fast-forwarding to just a few hundred years ago, where the poskim begin to talk about this phenomenon of non-Jewish names. On one extreme, we have the Maharam Shik. Maharam Shik was very forcefully against non-Jewish names, and he was one of the primary Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer. Also, very interesting historical note, his last name was Shik. What does Shik mean? So you can tell me it's a caterer, right? No. So Shik actually is an abbreviation. Where does it come from? No. That's what you think it's Yiddish, right? Exactly. He lived at a time where the government mandated that Jews had to have last names. I have to admit, this was a very this is an eye-opening experience for me. I come occasionally to the Sfardi Minyan downstairs. I give it to our Torah, and I meet some of the members here. And when I ask them their names, uniformly, Avraham ben Yitzchak. So I'm asking myself, is his last name ben Yitzchak? Because that would not be a surprise either. Sfardim very often have names which are really just other names. You know, their last names are first names. And they said, no, I'll tell you what my last name is, but that's how they identify themselves. And obviously in Middle Eastern lands especially, the concept of last name was a relatively late coming phenomenon. I have to tell you this story. I'm going off script over here, but this is too good. I think it was in Iraq, in Baghdad, going back maybe about 100 years. That's when, you know, those countries started mandating last names. And, you know, they had to have an official registrar come to your house and write down what your name was going to be. Very often, at least in Ashkenazic lands, it was based on profession, miller, tailor, you know, Schreiber, things like that. So in the Arab lands, they had a hard time finding the Jews. The Jews that either didn't want to participate or they were out of the house. The only time they could find the Jews at home was on Shabbos. So after a long time, they said, okay, we'll send our magistrates, the representatives of the government, to the house on Shabbos. So there are last names in Sephardi families such as Kel Yishmarini. Why? Because they were singing Smiros. So they said, oh, you know, what are we going to, right? How does it go? I'm blanking. Kel Shabbat, Kel Yishmarini. That's how they, right? They wanted to make sure that the last name would be so patently Jewish. And it was Shabbos, and so the Maharam Shik's family, maybe to spite the government in some way, I don't know, they chose the last name Shik, which stands for Shem Yisrael Kodesh. The Jews' names are holy. As if to say, all right, we'll take on your last name, but we're going to preserve the Jewish flavor. So Maharam Shik, no surprise, was extremely forceful against this practice of Jews in his time taking on secular names, and many of them, and this is very important, this was at the time of the rising reform movement. So the Chassam Sofer, who battled against the reform, and his student, the Maharam Shik, they had to stand their ground, and the names and the Jewish identity and persona was all the more important in that generation. So and he comes at it with two strong proofs. One is this Medrash. He says, how could it be that we're going to delay the Geula? The Geula from Mitzrayim was because we had these patently Jewish names. And others say maybe we're delaying the Geula from whatever country we happen to be in if we don't keep to our Hebrew names. But before we get to his proofs, take a look at the second paragraph. This is in source number one. The darkened box on the top is the Medrash, if you want to take a look at it later. But the left-hand column, B'Yoser Bir, he tells a little story about himself, which is, it's quite moving. Amarti akavona dihine B'Yosi Rav de Kila Kedosha Yergin Samach LePreshburg. He was a rabbi in this town, near Preshburg, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. At some point, as the clergyman for the town, I had to present certain documents, metrikal, I don't know, maybe someone can translate for exactly what that refers to, some sort of documents to the government. And I met up with his minister. His shraim lefonai, and he was very, very upset, and he was complaining to me. He says, how terrible is it that the Jews, this is the non-Jew speaking, how terrible is it that the Jews are calling themselves by secular names? He says, any other country that you go to, the pride of the culture, you know, someone who's French wants to be called Louis, right? Or he wants to be called Francis, something which identifies him as from where he comes from. And he says, they call themselves by non-Jewish names. Sharkol umos machshivan hashemos haboim lehem mirosh ha'uma. Others treasure names that are historically important to their countries. Dahainu, Ungarish, Francia, Bechadome, Kulum Achshivim Haloshim Hashem Shalom. They all take pride in their language and their names. They don't change it under any circumstances. Vayehudim Asherim Mikadmonei Ha'umos, Kiyumei Olam. The Jews are the oldest nation. And they're rejecting their heritage and calling themselves by a common name, by secular names. So when we get Musar from the non-Jews about our own practices, it has to wake us up a little bit. It has to wake us up a little bit. So that was what the Maharam Sheikh said. Let's take a look at one or two of his proofs, and then we'll take a look at the other side of the story. If you look at the scan there from the Gemara Lama Dalet Gittin, we just learned this last week in Yeshiva and YU. So Barishona Hayimashana Shmo. I'm looking at the Mishnah in the center. Barishona Hayimashana Shmo Ushma Shem Iro V'Shem Ira. Initially, when a get was written, obviously you have to identify the parties. The husband, the wife, where they come from, so we know who they are. Hiskin Rabbi Gamliel Zaken she kosiv ishploni b'chol shem sheyeshla. Ishplonis b'chol shem sheyeshla mevnei tikan olam. Rabbi Gamliel, of course, the Nasi, great figure in history, he instituted the following. He said what we should do, instead of just having the names, the first name and the last name, well, they didn't have last names, but instead of just the husband's name and the woman's name, we should also include their nicknames, other names that they go by. Maybe in one location it goes by this name. Another location, you know, I know people in business. In Manhattan, they go by one name. In Williamsburg, they go by another name. Depends who you're dealing with, right? There's Howard and there's Chaim, you know? So there you go. Okay. So it was important for a get to be associated with the parties, because otherwise you show up with this divorce paper, you want to get remarried. Who's Howard? We never heard of Howard. Chaim. Oh, we know you were married to Chaim. So Rabbi Gamliel instituted that you have to write the person's name and all other relevant names that he or she happened to go by. If you look at the Tosfos, in the right-hand column, towards the bottom, Vehu dischazik betrei shmei. Okay? Sholu l'Rabbeinu Tam al mumer lavodis kochavim. They asked Rabbeinu Tam, we need to write a get for a mumer lavodis kochavim. Someone who went off the derech, someone who was brought to Christianity. Shegirish es ishto, this individual, he divorced his wife. V'lo nechta beget el ashem shal yadus. The only thing that was written in the get was let's say Chaim, okay? But they didn't write his non-Jewish name that he goes by. Is it a kosher get? Or maybe our Mishnah is telling us, no, you have to write all the names that are relevant. Listen to what he said. Heshev Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam answered, Chalila lahaskir shem Ovid kochavim betoras Moshe Yisrael. God forbid that we should mention his non-Jewish name in the get. That's pretty strong. So based on that, the Maharam Sheikh says, how can we accept someone who writes who goes by a non-Jewish name? Pretty forceful. Just to give a smattering of one or two other side points before we get to the other side of the story. The Maharsham's name was Rav Shalom Shvadron. He was the grandfather of the Magid. Rabbi Kron's Magid was also by the name of Rav Shalom Shvadron. His grandfather in Europe was a great posek and not known as a machmir, not known to be very strict. He was asked about someone who embroidered a parochas for a shul, and the artist signed her name in Hungarian characters. A Hungarian name. And he asked, is that appropriate in the shul? And he said, it's not appropriate. This is the shul where we daven for the geula. So why would we emblazon on the Aron Kodesh a name which, again, the value that earned our geula was the Hebrew names? So he recommended they make a patch to cover it over, and I don't know how else they reformulated the name, but a startling psak. So let's look at the other side of the story. And I think the other side of the story also is very relevant to Thanksgiving, because we talk about the pilgrims, people escaping, religious persecution, coming to America.
I'm sorry, the Tosfos doesn't actually say you can't use the name Herbert.
Okay, great.
He says Hashem Avodah Zarah.
Okay.
If the guy's name is actually Christian, or
So we're going to come back to that in a couple of minutes. But Sam is making a great point. One way we could deflect this Tosfos is to say that the specific case was someone who was Jewish and then became Christian. And he's using the shame Ovid Kochavim, right? So maybe his name is Chris, right? So maybe Rabbeinu Tam is saying Chas v'Shalom to write Christopher or something like that in a get. Maybe that's not appropriate. But if it's just an English name, that's what I go by in business. You know, that's what people call me. That's what my parents called me. Maybe that would be okay. I was in touch with Rabbi Zilberman. Rabbi Zilberman is a colleague of mine, and he is very involved with the Beis Din of America. And I asked him about, you know, any cases recently where they dealt with non-Jewish names. So there isn't, you know, in medieval times, the Crusades, Rabbeinu Tam's era, there was a much more of a push, take people away from Judaism and baptize them, and we'll get back to that in a second. But he said, nowadays we don't have that so much. But he dealt with a case within the last 10 years of a Hindu convert. And the name that you take on, apparently, when you become a Hindu, is like your... That's how they call you in the prayer group. And it really is a name that is identifiable with the Avodah Zarah practice. So I think we can definitely accept what Sam is saying. And maybe this Tosfos is not a great proof because it's talking about a very specific situation, not commonly, you know, where we call people by different names in secular society.
How could Rabbeinu Tam argue with Rabbi Gamliel so openly?
So he wasn't arguing with Rabbi Gamliel. He was saying that Rabbi Gamliel was addressing the entire set of names that are relevant for a get could be Yaakov, Yankel, Yankala, you know, anything that is part of his Jewish portfolio, but anything that extends out is not. Okay, what I thought you were going to ask me, Mr. Glinter, I can't resist it. I'm going to jump the gun a little bit, but one of the replies to this argument in favor, or so to speak, you know, giving the stamp of approval to secular names is that historically, As we started this year, there have been so many great gedolim with names that were not Jewish at all. We'll get to that in a little while. Ramosha Feinstein points to the Magid Mishnah, whose name was Vidal. Okay, Ramosha in his photographic memory, I imagine he did this off the cuff. He said in the Tshuvas Rivash, in the response of the Rivash, there are 25 letters that are written to individuals without Jewish names. You know, sort of like, you know, one of these questions they asked Rabbi Chaim Kanevsky, how many times does this word appear in the entire Torah? You know, just like that, like a search on the computer. So it was not uncommon. Take a look. This is, once you mention Rabbeinu Tam, look at the bottom left corner. You can't make this up. You can't make this up. This is Daf Ches, also in Gittin. Sha'al Rabbeinu Peter l'Rabbeinu Tam. A contemporary of Rabbeinu Tam himself was not just a guy by the name of Peter, Rabbeinu Peter. In every yeshiva in the world, they get up to this Tosfos, they read it, Rabbeinu Peter. I don't know how it was pronounced in France at the time. But and this is important because Ramosha Feinstein, we're going to see he's the one who justifies the practice of giving secular names. He does add a caveat that naming after a Russia, naming after a figure in another religion would be problematic.
Peter was a...
Exactly. So,
he was a Jew.
He was a Jew, right.
They all were.
So you remind me of something, which is not for now, because this is a whole different shiur, but this is a very cool shiur. There is a lot of research to demonstrate, and I think Peter, Paul, they might have been part of this. Again, I'm not, you know, this is a question like for Professor Schneer Lyman. We'll have to bring him in for an, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there were certain individuals, leaders in the Christian movement, that were actually double agents. The Chachamim deliberately put people in place who would lead the Christian movement off, you know, like off the deep end, so to speak, so that it would be very clear where the dividing line between, because that was the problem, because everyone was Jewish, right? You know, there's Reform, there's Conservative, there's Orthodox, and over, you know, different periods in history, people could go either way, right? And, yeah, go ahead.
So then Rabbi Breidowitz was shared last week from Rosh Hashanah that he said that those Chachamim were inserted in order to make a very clear dividing line between Judaism as we had it.
Right.
And then that Christianity should split off. So right. That's modern.
Exactly.
Two religions should not be.
I'm going to say something very controversial, so I'll be careful how I say it, but... But there's a relevance in our day also. You know, sometimes we have, rabbis are challenged sometimes to embrace the big tent, you know, and obviously the Achdus is very important on many levels. But as a community, as an institution, we also have to be careful because if the tent is too big, then we may give the misimpression that movements that are not in line with orthodoxy don't get the same credibility, and that seems to have precedence in what we're talking about. You know, the early Christians were Jews. Okay, so here we have Rabbeinu Peter, Rabbeinu Peter, but let's look at the Marashdam. Marashdam is on your second page. Marashdam was writing. This goes back a few hundred years. He was addressing the Anusim Shabo'u mi Portugal. Following the Inquisition, there were many Jews who had initially were conversos, and they were baptized and whatnot, and it took a while till some of them were able to escape. They came to Tzfas in the 1600s, and they were trying to restart their communities. Excuse me. And many of them were baptized with Goyish names, with non-Jewish names. And they wanted to know what we're supposed to do. They wanted to take on Jewish names, but they still had business partners back in Europe or in different locations, and they had to maintain communication with them. And if suddenly Chaim would send them a letter and a check and a contract, who's Chaim, right? So they want to know, think how poignant this is. You are breaking from 100 years of this tension in your family of being a hidden Jew or someone who's being persecuted, and now you finally made a break for it, and now I'm frum, and I can exercise my religion as I please, and now I have to go back to my Christian name. So they asked, is that okay? So we don't have time to go through everything, but in short, he points to a Gemara, a very interesting Gemara in Nedarim, that says that one is not allowed to identify themselves as a non-Jew. It used to be where, a toll collector, a tax collector, you need to check off the box, ethnicity and religion. And if you checked off the Jewish religion, it was a problem. You're going to get stuck. You're going to get caught at the border or whatever. And is it permissible to say, actually, I'm a Christian. I'm or whatever faith happens to be. And it's not permissible.
What about other?
Other, yeah, that didn't exist. There wasn't a box like that in those days. No. No, that's more recent legislation. So what he said is that in any situation where the person receiving the letter is not going to think that your use of that name is really because you're identifying yourself as a non-Jew, right? The person who checks off the box, who identifies himself as not Jewish, may also be dressed in a certain way, presents himself as a goy, and so forth. But anytime it's abundantly clear that your name does not represent anything more than just what you're called, your the way that people speak to you or reach out to you, so then that's fine. And he points to a fascinating Gemara. Once again, go back to the first page. This is also Gemara in Gittin, so you have the full yeshiva experience this morning. Bottom right. Okay, this is from the first parak, Daf Yud Aleph. Esve Gittin Haboy Medina Sayam. If you have a get that is sent with a shaliach, with a messenger from another country. And again, we try to ascertain the validity of the get. If it shows up from somewhere else, we need to make a few phone calls, find out who wrote this get. Edim chasumim aleihem. There are witnesses signed on the bottom of the get. Af al pi sheshmos sehem kishemos ovdi kochavim. Even if the names of the individuals who sign, who testify to the validity of the get, are non-Jewish names, kisherin. The get is still kosher. Why? Mipnei sherov Yisrael shebuchutz la'aretz shmos sehem kishemos ovdi kochavim. Most Jews, historically, this is 2,000 years ago, maybe a little bit less than that. Most Jews in Chutz La'aretz go by secular names. That's a pretty strong statement. And the Gemara says, based on that, if we have a get, we have a legal document that has a name, which is not a Jewish name, we can actually accept that document. And we don't have to wonder if maybe the source of this is somewhat questionable. So it would lead us to believe that the basis for the justification is probably, if we're going to swing back to the Maharam Shik where we started, Maharam Shik again was against those who were trying to identify themselves in a more assimilated fashion, even if they were full-fledged observant Jews, but they wanted to integrate into society as much as possible. Perhaps, as Rosh Weiss explains, if the intention of that name is by no means to try to, again, blur the lines between Jews and non-Jews, but simply a way to identify oneself to non-Jewish colleagues, then maybe that's okay. Another thing he says, let's go back to that Medrash, right? The Medrash said that they had these three or four defining characteristics of Jews in Mitzrayim. Rav Asher Weiss says, maybe What would have been their downfall was if all three were changed. But if we maintain some of those identifying features, then it doesn't disrupt the geula from marching forward. Okay? Along those lines, Moshe says, why are we making such a big deal about names? When was the last time you met someone who just spoke Hebrew all day? Right? He says it's a wonderful thing to speak Hebrew all day. The Rambam says it's a mitzvah to learn Hebrew. And it's interesting, the Rambam also says that sometimes we have difficulty understanding lines in the Mishnah and the Gemara because over the years, the Jews did not always speak in Hebrew and there were certain definitions that were lost. He said, I don't know where the basis for this is, but he says it very clearly. Like Rabbeinu Tam, like the Tosas we just read, right? Those were written in France. That's where the Rishonim, the Ashkenazi Rishonim were. France, Germany. When they were writing, they wrote in Rabbinic Hebrew. But he says when they taught in yeshiva, their Talmidim, they spoke in French because that's what everyone understood. And every once in a while, Rashi on Chumash, when he wants to explain what a word means, he'll say, this is how you say it in French. Right? So apparently the vernacular was very popular. So that doesn't bother anybody. And the geula from being in Gullus. So the name maybe shouldn't bother anyone in the same way, especially because, and this is key, look at page 2. It's on the bottom of page 2, I believe. Yeah, look at number 4 on the bottom. Moshe says something very sharp. Mitzad etzem ha-dover sh'mashanam esh'moseyem l'shimus nochrim. I'm sorry. Let's go to number 3. I apologize. Okay. On the left, you see at the end of that first line, shalchein b'shvil ha-muna sh'yigalu v'rotzu sh'yu nikarim sh'heim Yisrael, because of their great belief in the fact that they'd ultimately be redeemed from Mitzrayim, and they wanted to maintain their Jewish identity. And higul ha-hakvish l'ishanam sh'mam, v'lishanam sh'shonam, they were careful to keep their names and their language. That's why it's so important to geula, because the only reason they bothered keeping themselves Jewish by, you know, with these features is because they believed that they were going to get out someday, right? Assimilation often happens because you throw in the towel and say, like, you know, we're here for good, that's it. Aval achar matan Torah, here's the key line. Achar matan Torah, ein lanu chiv midina, gam lo minyani zehirus umusar, al mashit tavinu hatayag mitzos ledoros. He says, practically speaking, after the Torah is given, anything the Jews did, even if they institutionalized it, and it was something that everybody did, is no longer going to be universally binding upon us. In other words, the way that they behaved to keep their Jewish identity alive before the Torah was given, that's because there was no other way to identify a Jew. Now that a Jew has mitzvos, he wears a yarmulke, he wears tzitzis, he does this mitzvah, he does that mitzvah, he keeps Shabbos, those are the things that identify a Jew. So it was valiant and noble and very appropriate of the Jews in Mitzrayim to do so, but it doesn't mean it's incumbent upon us in the same way, because we, since then, have taken on so many other ways in which we identify ourselves as Jewish. Okay? So therefore, based on that, Ramosha says the whole Medrash is no longer a strong force against using secular names. Reminds me of a story, because now I'm in Queens. This is a very Queens story. So Rabbi Rakefet, right, his sister? Yeah. Right. So Rabbi Rakefet, one of his books is a biography of Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Rabbi Eliezer Silver was one of the Gedolim in America in the 30s, the 40s, when Ramosha Feinstein came here, and he was very active. He would fly all over the country to Europe. He tried to help save Jews in the Holocaust. He was a very colorful personality. I think he once got pulled over. Someone was driving. He was in the back seat, and they were speeding. And the cop, he rolled down the window, and the driver said, officer, do you know who I have in the car? I said, who do you have in the car? I have in the back seat the chief rabbi of the United States of America. To which, later, he rolled down his window and said, and Canada. So he was a very, very colorful personality. So at one of the early Aguda conventions, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, all of us, was a young man at the time, young rabbi, and he was called to speak. And as he was called up, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, one of the older rabbanim said, how could it be the Aguda leadership, we're going to have someone who goes by the name Fabian? Yeah. So Rabbi Silver got up and said, if Rabbeinu Tam can have a colleague by the name of Rabbi Peter, we can have Rabbi Fabian also. So he made sure to back him up. A few more minutes. So on that topic, Rav Moshe said we didn't maintain the Hebrew of old. In every country we spoke in the vernacular. Rabbi Moshe Weinberger from uh, from from Woodmere tells a story about that. This family made Aliyah. They tried Aliyah in the 70s. They got there. Taxi driver, you know, one of the first days that they're there, pulls up. And you know, the driver says, you know, where are we going? So his father says, Vayomer Elecha. Yeah, he's like, start speaking to him like a chumash. You know, he had no idea what he was talking about. But he assumed that, you know, if you're in Hebrew, you speak Lashon HaKodesh in the classic sense, you know, the way it was always spoken. But even our Hebrew nowadays is not the Hebrew. Even the names in modern Hebrew, a name like Ilan, it's a very common name. It means something in Hebrew, but there was never anyone named biblically by the name Ilan, right? Eitan, how did I get the name Eitan? It's a great story. Okay, this is what my parents told me. My second name is Avigdor, which is my father's side, and Chaim on my mother's side. But apparently when I was born, my parents called up their friends who had made Aliyah, and they said, what's a really popular Zionist name right now? So my parents had big plans for me. I told my parents, I'd love to make Aliyah, but the young Israel of Hillcrest is calling. So, you know, Mirtz Hashem. One day we'll get there too. But that's where the name Eitan comes from. But Eitan appears in the Torah, but it's not a name in Lashon HaKodesh. Okay, but it became integrated. And that's really what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. Putting aside modern Hebrew names, but he says even the Yiddish names. For hundreds of years we use Yiddish names because there must be like a statute of limitations. At some point, a name becomes so embraced in the Jewish community that it's also a Jewish name. That's a fascinating insight. Fascinating insight. And that's another reason why, again, names which don't necessarily have any biblical significance to them also became normalized in our practices. Like Gittel. I'm going to talk about Alexander in a second. Before I get to Alexander, one more point. It's also widely discussed amongst the poskim, even if we don't go as far as to embrace every name out there. And Ramosha, interestingly, he was asked about this in the 60s and then again in the 80s. In the 60s, he says to have a non-Jewish name it's not usser, but it's a davar maguna. Maguna means not so nice. In a later tshuva to a young man who wants to know if he should name his daughter after his mother, who had a name which wasn't a Jewish name, but I think had a Yiddish name, Rav Moshe said, what I meant was it's not a nice thing if you're just going to pick a name out of the hat, you know, but a name that has been integrated into a popular culture, of Jewish culture, it has the stamp of approval like Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. It's not the same as something out of the blue, which is patently not Jewish. Oh, okay. So Yosheber. So Yosef Dov. So another line that the poskim draw, so to speak, is that a name which is Abraham, Yitzchak, Isaac. Right? There have always been people named Yitzchak, Isaac. Right? If the name is essentially a Jewish name, but it's just English side, but anglicized. Okay. That doesn't take away from its Jewish flavor. Right. And that should be okay. That should be okay. I'm just going to mention on that topic, that's very important because sometimes, you know, getting back to Vidal. So obviously we have famous Vidal, Jewish Vidals, Vidal Sassoon, Sfardi. So the other Sfardim that Ramosha was talking about, the Rav Vidal. So in one shuv, he just identifies Vidal as a name that was used by Sfardim, even though Vidal isn't a Hebrew name. In another shul, he says something fascinating. And I asked, one of my talmidim is from Panama. So I asked him to help me out a little bit with, a part of my Spanish. You know, but Rav Moshe, I don't fully understand the tshuva. It sounds like he was going back and forth with someone who either knew French or didn't know French that well. But Vidal, anyone know what Vidal means? Chaim. Vidal is Chaim. So in a certain sense, Abraham, and Tova, or, you know, Toiva or something like that. It's really not that different. So Vidal, it also is very insightful because I always thought Chaim meant life. If you name someone Chaim, you can. So Vidal is like vital, say in English. Or Ramosha actually writes this in his tshuva. Besides Vidal, vivant. Vivant doesn't mean life, it means alive. So when you name someone Chaim, you're actually, it's also like a bracha of vitality. Vidal, vitality and vigor. That's a very special bracha. Very special bracha. Okay, let's just try to wrap it up. So Alexander is one thing I wanted to mention. Alexander has an interesting backstory to it because that is a very popular Jewish name. Alexander Ziskin. Ziskin is a Yiddish-sized version of Alexander. Alexander, how did that become a Jewish name? So we have in the Gemara, Alexander the Great was marching on Jerusalem. And he wanted to dominate the world. He was gonna destroy the Beis Hamikdash. And as he approached, the Kohen Gadol, Shimon HaTzadik, comes to greet him, and he gets down off his horse. And the soldiers are just flabbergasted. When did the emperor ever get down off his horse? He's about to march on Yerushalayim. And he said, no, I will not attack this place. Because when he saw the face of the Kohen Gadol, he said, I see this face every night in my dream before I go out to war, and that's how I know I'm going to be successful. If that's not, you know, from Hashem, I don't know what to tell you. So the story continues. It's not in the Gemara, but in Yosifon. Yosifon is a form of Josephus translated into Hebrew. It's not exactly the same as Josephus, but apparently Alexander didn't want to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, but he asked if a statue of, you know, of his likeness could be placed in the Beis HaMikdash. And they said, okay, maybe there's another way we could, you know, commemorate your kindness. And he said, for the next 12 months, every Kohen who has a child, a boy, we're going to name him Alex. We're going to name him Alexander. And that is how it made its way into Yiddishkeit. So Rav Moshe says, even if you adopt what I said initially, that to take on a non-Jewish name, a non-Jewish king, you know, what's the significance for us? So that it's not usher, but he says it's not so nice either. But if it's there for Akaras HaTov, it serves a very specific purpose to recognize the kindness of Alexander the Great. Then, you know, that's a good reason. That's a good reason to integrate it into Jewish practices. Okay, so let me just finish with one interesting side note that I came across a lot of interesting points that Rav Moshe makes in the context of naming children. Two more points. We'll be done in 6 minutes. If you look at number 8 on the last page, so first thing Rav Moshe deals with in the paragraph labeled Dalid is a person who was given a name at birth, Manoach, the father of Shimshon, and his parents also called him, the best I can do, turn this into English, is Norwich. That was his name. His birth certificate says Norwich. Norvite. I think that's what he means. Okay? So you want to know, he was a rabbi. He was an Orthodox rabbi, and he went by the name Norwich, and he wanted to know, maybe I'd like to go by Manoach. I'd like to go by Hebrew name. Is it a breach of Kibbutz Avaim not to go by the name that my parents referred to me? So Rav Moshe says, no, it's not a breach of Kibbutz Avaim. So on the contrary, parents don't really care that much. And he said, if they do care, they won't care that much if you're taking on your Jewish name. It's not like you turned to Norwich for Norman. You know, you took a name. You're a rabbi. You want to be, instead of Mark, you want to be Menachem. You know, I know people like that. Wonderful. Okay? That's what he deals with in Dalit. And hey, I'm sorry. Oh, go back to number 7 at the top. He says, what he's dealing with is the following question. In a get, so as we mentioned earlier, you may have to write multiple names. But it was suggested maybe the English names don't count. Maybe the only things we care about are the Hebrew names. Everything else is a nickname and will be written separately. Rav Moshe says, how could you say that? Most people get their English name before they get their Hebrew name. Most people get their English name in the hospital. And I learned this the hard way, and I tell my chassanim, I tell midim, some people are very makpid not to even fill out the birth certificate and social security forms in the hospital. You don't have to, but you're going to have to wait on a really long line somewhere, you know, in the city, a few weeks later, because people don't want to give a name at all until the bris. And there isn't really basis for that. If you want to just take care of the paperwork while you're in the hospital, it's going to make your life a lot easier. But Rav Moshe acknowledges that the name is already that you probably have your English name before you got your Hebrew name. I would say it's important. I tell this to people as well. If God forbid a child has to stay in the hospital for an extended period of time, the NICU or whatever, very often you hear a mishaber for tinok or tinoket bas so and so, and it's not advisable. It's better to give the name early, even if the bris is going to be delayed. First of all, there's no halachic reason to wait, but apparently studies show that medical professionals in the hospital relate better in terms of care to a baby that has a name. They can call it something. And if it's just this amorphous, you know, little doll, it's harder for the nurses to give it. Very interesting. Rav Schefter joked at the bris of our two boys, Aaron and Baruch. So the first thing he said to me right after the bris was over, he said, oh, the nurses named the babies A and B. I said, you're right. Okay. With this, we will conclude. At the bottom of page 4, number 9, Rav Asher Weiss does make an important point. After justifying, after taking sides with Rav Moshe and other poskim and explaining why it is that secular names would be permissible, he says we shouldn't rob ourselves of the awareness of the significance of the Hebrew name all the same. there is a reason why we make a big deal about the Hebrew name, and we give a Hebrew name, and we call a person by that name, because the name has a certain hashpa, has a certain influence on how the person develops, right? And that's why we talk about the name at a bris, we talk about the name at a kiddush for a girl, because we hope that, and we believe that there's a connection. The namesake, the midos of the namesake have a connection. In a few weeks, we're going to read about the descendants of Esav, and one of them's name was Korach. He had a grandson by the name of Amalek, and he had a grandson by the name of Korach. So the Medrash says, you know, what do you expect? Korach, down the line, you know. That was his name. Shema Garam. The Gemara says that a person's name doesn't mean you can't rise above that, but the name is very significant, very significant. And one of my favorite words to say at a bris or at a Shalom Zachar, we always call it Keshem Shenechnas a bris, Keni Kanas a Torah Chupa Maisim Tov, right? It's a little bit funny. Keshem, the same way that he comes into the bris, also, you know, the Chasana and Torah and so forth. So Keshem, isn't that strange? What, is he going to change his name before, I get, maybe the woman will change her last name, but like, what's going to happen between the bris? We translate it's Keshem, you know, the, in the same way that he reached this milestone, the child should read that. So Rabbi Gedalia Shor says no. He says the Peshat is very, very, very literal. Kishem, with all the qualities that this name contains, that the parents, with their perhaps Ruach HaKodesh, chose this name to imbue and endow the child with that persona and that, those characteristics, that name should be the guiding force, just as it got him to this point. Kishem Shenech Lebris, Kein Nikanis Latoral, as they develop, as they mature, those midos should develop and manifest themselves into a successful member of the Jewish community. Have a wonderful holiday, a wonderful Thanksgiving, a wonderful Shabbos. Thank you so much. Yes, please.
Rabbi, I think Eitan, as Eitan, I think it's mentioned in the Machzor on Yom Kippur.
Yes.
And also with